to sleep with one eye open, but that's physically impossible.
Good night!
Rocky declared with such bravado you'd think he was playing Jean Valjean in Les Mis, not a detective whose trip to Disney World had been thwarted. We all watched as he stormed out of the room. Once the sound of his waterproof khakis rubbing together cleared, everyone started to file out, eyeing one another suspiciously, the true MVPs landing back at the horseshoe-shaped bar. Megan and I sat there with the Long Island sisters, exchanging theories. What do you think about the guy in the bucket hat and his girlfriend? Something fishy, Megan said, sipping her martini.
I agree, Sister One piped in. I watched them leave the party, and as soon as they rounded the corner, they quit holding hands.
Forget the May-December romance, I added. What's with the skeezy real estate guy?
He gives me bad vibes.
No one that young comes to one of these. The same could be said for you. I looked over, and sure enough, it was Dagger Eyes walking past the bar.
A writer from Los Angeles.
Sounds made up.
Made up?
You said your husband's name is Cheese. Perhaps we should call him Daya, because that shit's clearly fake. Another fantastic joke wasted on ears that had clearly never heard of soy cheese, let alone a specific brand name. I tried again.
Or maybe we should call him Swiss, because your story has some holes in it.
Big, gentle Cheese spoke up from behind his wife. Actually, it's short for Juan Cheese, who is the last ruler of the Roanoke Island Native American tribe, very well revered. I nodded and went back to my drink as Dagger Eyes snapped her fingers to get Cheese to follow her, like she was Danny Zuko rallying the T-Birds. Megan and I kept the bar stools warm for a while, even after the sisters ran out of vape juice and called it a night. Just when we were about to do the same, who rounds the corner but old douchey real estate guy? He sidled up to the opposite end of the bar and ordered a McUltra. A man scared of carbohydrates, extra suspicious.
So what's your deal?
Real estate, huh? More like get real estate. I whipped my head to Megan, who nodded in approval of my wordplay. Yep, real estate in Atlanta. The market's very hot right now, he said with a smirk.
About how long is that drive from Atlanta?
I asked with an eyebrow raised. Well, no, we decided a private jet down here.
Megan and I scoffed in his face. Private jet? Yeah, right. Who takes a private jet for an hour flight besides a Kardashian?
Like I said, the market is hot. Now, I'm going to go meet my girl. You two ladies enjoy your drinks and good luck, you know, raping dudes or whatever.
Yes.
You heard that correctly.
Take a moment.
This motherfucker, with his low-carb beer and high-and-mighty attitude, wished us luck on raping dudes or whatever. We sat there in shock as he walked away, each with a hand to our chest like a flabbergasted Southern Belle.
What have we ever done to him? And who uses rape as a punchline? What an asshole!
Megan and I headed back to our probably haunted room in silence, reeling from the night's events. I had no doubt in my mind that real estate douche was a fraud. But who did he want to put a hit out on? And why?
He told you to have fun vaping, dudes?
Sister number two asked me at breakfast the next morning, blowing a strawberry-scented chemical cloud away from the table. Before I could correct her, a pissed-off older woman came storming through the banquet doors.
Where is that no-good cheating rat? She screamed.
Homegirl was working those local theater chops as well as my nerves. It was too damn early for screaming. Her head turned Linda Blair style to the young hottie.
Oh, if it isn't the tramp that's sleeping with my husband.
Tramp? He said you were divorced. Someone yelled to look outside, and sure enough, there was Bucket Hat hopping over the handrail and making a getaway.
We aren't divorced yet, the wife screeched. Not until he agrees to give me the house.
Before wife and hottie could claw each other's eyes out, Rocky got in between them. Apparently, Bucket Hat had been cheating on his wife while telling the mistress he was single. Things were really starting to heat up, so Rocky, of course, dismissed us to lunch. We spent the afternoon lounging by the pool, drinking margaritas, and telling everyone within earshot about raping Dudegate.
You know, come to think of it, I've never seen him at one of these before.
But what could he possibly have to do with the affair? Sister number two asked. Apparently, the Long Island girls attended murder mystery weekends all over the East Coast several times a year. And they weren't the only ones. Over by the cabana, Dagger Eyes and Cheese were eating barbecue they'd brought from home to give to Rocky. He'd been their murder mystery host before, and they were old buds. It was like we became part of a whole community I never even knew existed. Later at dinner, I wasn't three bites in before Rocky burst through the doors once more.
There's been a murder. Everyone follow me.
I swear, this weekend was almost becoming a cleanse. The real victim of the weekend was my buzz, because I couldn't get a sip down without someone busting into the banquet hall. We followed Rocky out of the ballroom and down a flight of stairs. Sure enough, a murdered bucket hat lay lifeless on the sidewalk, stabbed through the heart with a butter knife. Questions raced through my brain. Who killed Bucket Hat? Why would they use a butter knife? When was the buffet gonna refill the goddamn mashed potatoes? At the bar later, I sat with Megan and the Long Island sisters discussing theories. Every time someone from the murder mystery walked past the bar, I convinced them to take a seat and tell me their theories, hoping they had a lead or could find the connection between Bucket Hat's murder and the original hit that was put out. One by one, Megan and I told our tale of the night before and how odd it was. And soon, everyone was intrigued with the douche. Hell, even Dagger Eyes and Cheese finally caved and had a drink with us. I'd like to think it was because I had proved to them my innocence, but she told me, "Honey, I Wikipedia'd you last night, so I know you're telling the truth." Several drinks later, I laid in bed trying to put together the puzzle pieces. I just couldn't figure it out. And right before I drifted off, it hit me. "I got it!" I yelled, sitting straight up in bed. "Got what?" Megan asked sleepily. "I got our motives," I said, pulling the covers tightly around me as I smiled from ear to ear. The next morning, Megan and I headed to breakfast, rocking matching shirts in solidarity. If you want to see a picture of how cute we are in our matching Forever 21 Friends Forever shirts, there's a picture of it in the PDF attached. I walked in confidently, feeling like we'd really 12 angry men, these retirees. Margot took her place as I made extended eye contact with the douche while shoveling grits in my mouth. We have had quite the weekend, haven't we? Before all is revealed, let's go around and share our theories, huh? Then, just like we'd introduced ourselves at the first dinner, table by table, everyone stood up and regaled the room with their scenario. Most were tired old theories that the wife put a hit out on Bucket Hat because he was obviously cheating on her with that youngin', and after the hit woman got shot, the wife came down to do it herself. Seemed too obvious. Of course, Dagger Eyes' theory involved Megan and I being a part of the crime, despite our olive branch from the night before. Finally, our table was called, the last one to go. "Wait, what are we saying again?" Megan asked. "Don't worry, I got this," I reassured her, standing up. I cleared my throat dramatically. "Well, well, well. I loved listening to everyone's simplistic finger-pointing," I said, staring down Dagger Eyes. "Your Wikipedia said you had an acting degree," she said, as Cheese took her arm to sit her back down. "I, however, have come up with a different conclusion. You see, my friend here and I," Megan pointed to her shirt, "had such a vile interaction with this guy," Megan pointed to the douche, "that we knew there's no way he can't be in on it. No one is that big of a dickhead, so he has to be an actor. So, my theory is that this," and I used air quotes, "real estate agent here, took out the hit on Bucket Hat because he is the wife's real estate agent and wants her to get the house they share so she can sell it and he can make the commission. When it didn't go as planned, he tipped off the wife to cause a diversion so he could kill Bucket Hat himself. Ha-ha! Gotcha," I said, pointing my finger at him. "How's that for raping a dude?" I mimed a mic drop, high-fived Megan, and sat down. The room was dead silent. I leaned back in my chair, proud of cracking the case. That is, until I felt a little tap on my shoulder. I looked up, and there was the douche holding a business card. John Doe Real Estate. I tried to laugh like I was kidding as I scanned the room and all its shocked faces. Dagger Eyes was appalled. I slinked down into my seat as the silence grew to a dull roar. Finally, Margot cleared her throat. "Okay, that was interesting." She moved past it and brought everyone's attention back to her, like there was some gruesome car crash in the room and she didn't want anyone to look. Turns out while Megan and I tried to think out of the box on what the answer could be, it was the classic case of husband cheats on wife so the wife puts a hit on him, but it goes awry and she comes down to do the dirty work herself. It was textbook. We had overthought the whole thing. I yearned for a bucket hat to pull down over my eyes. Meanwhile, everyone else was celebrating their victory. Since so many people had it right, they ended up just drawing a name for the winner. The prize was a discount off their next murder mystery weekend, which we knew they'd be attending as soon as possible. But not Megan and me. The second after Margot wished everyone a safe trip back home, Megan and I full-on sprinted out of there, cackling as we ran past the trees. I had somehow been a bigger disaster than the cast of Southern Charm.
And let me remind you, two of them dug a hole in the beach and slept under branches because their golf cart ran out of gas and couldn't find their way home. Megan, were we assholes? Did maybe the guy not deserve that smear campaign we brought against him? I asked her as we drove over the bridge away from the club. Megan thought about it for a second, twisting her face in confusion before finally saying, "Nah, that guy made a rape joke. What a douche." And she was right. I was happy to leave the murder mystery with zero mystery still in my brain. No unanswered questions. Except, why in the hell Dagger Eye's friend requested me on Facebook 3 days later? Pick a lane, woman. Love at first fight. My heterosexual life partner, Melissa, uses a phrase that I love. This is my life now. She busts this out whenever we're trying something new and she falls in love with it. The best part about this is that most of these activities are usually dumb as hell. Here are some actual moments where I've witnessed Melissa say this. Sitting in a Monster Jam audience as Gravedigger, the most famous monster truck from North Carolina, a vision of neon green and purple, flies through the air. This is my life now. Being stoned on a kayak in the marina and almost being attacked by a sea lion. This is my life now. And in text form. I just ate mushrooms on a boat, then sailed to a little island and fell in love with some baby raccoons. This is my life now. Never have I felt more Melissa, aka more ready to dedicate my life to something super dumb, than the moment I first walked through the doors of a WWE wrestling match at the impressionable age of 29. It was in that moment, 4 years ago, that everything changed. I had been aware of wrestling as a kid, but was never into it. And as an adult, my feelings were more like, the WWE is ridiculous. A bunch of people chanting along to theme songs, silly costumes and storylines, over-the-top shit talk, that is so immature. That all changed when I got to see my first live performance. I can now proudly say, as an educated and I'd like to think smart woman, that I love wrestling. Here's how it went down. Somehow, back in 2013, while I was visiting L.A., Grace was gifted with free tickets to WWE Raw. We didn't have anything better to do, so we actually considered going. Grace was like me. She'd been aware of wrestling when she was younger, but didn't pay it a second thought as an adult. But as soon as we walked into Staples Center that night in 2013 and felt the energy of that room, everything changed for the both of us. All those ways I used to pass off this phenomenon, the exact same words I said before, were now said in a different intonation. The WWE is ridiculous! A bunch of people chanting along the theme songs, silly costumes and storylines, over-the-top shit talk? Ah! That is so immature! This was my life now. As someone who has a theater degree, wrestling is pure art. WWE is basically theater in the round, just like Shakespeare's Globe Theater. But what makes it even better is that there's no pretending that the audience can't see you. The audience is part of the show. Wrestlers aren't just navigating the narrative, they're also bouncing off the crowd's energy and off the turnbuckles as they do complicated moves. Romeo never had to deliver a soliloquy that ends in a pointed elbow drop, am I right? Another reason why I love wrestling is because while there are a million storylines, they're relatively easy to follow. You could go in there with no prior knowledge of a character's long history of backstabbing and walk out an expert on how he was backstabbed by his BFF tag team partner and now he's going to seek vengeance on his former teammate. Seasons of history are often filtered down to a 5-minute backstory thanks to beautifully edited video packages of previous matches playing on the massive screens. Sometimes you'll look out and get dramatic monologues filled with tons of exposition, ideally delivered with a single spotlight and usually ending with their enemy bum-rushing the stage to hit him upside the head with a metal chair. Bonus points if they accidentally knock out the ref. It's a total soap opera circus. Now, some purists out there might say that since Grace and I haven't been watching wrestling since its beginning, that we are fake fans. And I say, I'm a fake fan. Everything about wrestling is fake. I am literally a fake fan. That's why we love it so much. So much so that we decided to make the ultimate gesture and fucking prove it. So in the spring of 2017, exactly 1 year after I had wrestled my emotions in the street of France, Grace and I invited Jarrett to join us in attending the biggest event of the year, WrestleMania 33 in gorgeous Orlando, Florida. We got in late Saturday night and kept it chill, saving our energy for the next day, as if we were going to be the ones in the ring. While Grace had a lot of editing and napping to do, Jarrett and I struck out on our own that Sunday for food and drinks. The last time we were together, as you'll remember, we were gallivanting around Paris, drinking incredible Bordeaux and eating pommes frites. How are we going to top that culinary experience? Culture at its finest. Downtown Disney. Neither of us had any interest in going to actual Disney World. I myself have never been a Disney person. It might stem back to the only time I went to Disney World back in seventh grade. To this day, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but after snapping a pic of Dale from the famed Rescue Rangers, I was wrongly accused of hitting him. I know, right? I don't know if it was someone else, or he got swiped by a stroller, or he just had a vendetta against me because he heard of my distaste for rodents, but that chipmunk wrongly snitched on me, and I have never forgotten. Since then, I have no real interest in being around mute mascots. I'd rather stay on the outskirts of the park and hit up something that has never done me wrong. Theme restaurants. And oh, there were plenty of them. We drank Cheetoritas at Rainforest Cafe, and then Raptoritas at the T-Rex Cafe, which is my new favorite spot and future wedding venue if I ever bump my head hard enough that it kicks in some desire to get married. Seriously, though, this place is incredible and stokes every aspect of my obsession with comically large things. From its glacier room that had Florida 30-foot ceiling fake ice walls and animatronic woolly mammoths, to the massive prehistoric octopus that looms over the bar, it's cheesy heaven. And in classic theme restaurant form, they lay the theme on real thick with the menu names. Some of their specialties include tar pit fried shrimp. I get it. Dinos got stuck in tar pits, yada yada. But with the Gulf oil spill of recent years, don't you think it's maybe not the best idea to conjure up the idea of tar when presenting diners with your seafood? Lava lasagna! 'Cause that doesn't immediately make you feel like you're gonna burn the shit out of the roof of your mouth as soon as you dig in, right? Pterosaur wings. I get where they're going here, with pterodactyls being the only dinosaur with wings, but why do they have to add the soar to the end? If you don't read that as tear a soar, ugh, then congrats, you are much classier than I am. Couldn't they just be taro wings? They really should have gone for taro bleed tasty wings and saved us gross-minded folks the visual. I decided to go for the menu item they gave up trying to cleverly name. The kale and red quinoa salad. But a little healthy salad was no match for those specialty drinks. So by the time we got to the stadium, we were pretty lit. And we needed to be, because, my God, walking into the middle of 100,000 screaming wrestling fans is intense. We met up with our WWE contact, a super on top of it woman who led us to our seats. I knew we'd be close since my girl Tess, a.k.a. Doc Orgasm, hooked it up. But we actually had no idea how good they were going to be. As we emerged from the tunnel, we trailed single file behind her, mouths agape like a line of shocked baby ducks as we got closer and closer to the ring. "Here are your seats," she said, gesturing to them. "And remember that you can take them with you as souvenirs at the end of the night." She power walked away, leaving the three of us standing silent in shock. We were in the fourth row, ringside, a.k.a. the 50-yard line of what was usually a massive football stadium. We took our seats as the sun set in that Orlando sky, military fighter jets flying overhead as Tinashe sang, "America the Beautiful." I don't know if I've ever felt more American or redneck and thankful of everything I'd done in my life to lead me to that moment. The next 5 hours were pure insanity, more matches than an arsonist's wet dream. I felt like I was going to have whiplash from jerking my head around to the ramp every time another theme song started spontaneously blasting. There were comebacks from 90s tag teams, the Hardy Boys, retirement matches from legends, the Undertaker, and even a proposal, John Cena and Nikki Bella. But it was the bad guys who really brought their A-game, including an insane tape segment where Randy Orton burned down the family compound of his opponent, Bray Wyatt. When this played, everyone went nuts. "That's super fucked up," I said, as screen showed the house engulfed in flames. "Super fucked up," Grace nodded in agreement before snapping back to amp mode. "Good thing it's not real." Oh, yeah. I was so consumed by the energy of the night that I had momentarily forgotten that these plot lines were written by paid professionals. Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt were prob's besties in real life and hitting up the nearest Hooters after the match.
At the end of the night, we were thrilled but exhausted, and we headed to the area where our driver was supposed to be picking us up, recounting all the details of the night as we schlepped with our commemorative seats in tow.
That was absolute madness, Jarrett said, still in shock. Can you believe the Hardy Boys made a comeback? Or that we were three of only 100,000 of John Cena's closest friends he chose to propose in front of? Gray said, shaking her head as we hopped into the Escalade.
For reals. But what was up with the house burning thing? Do we really need to promote arson to an audience with children present?
I asked with a disapproving squint that makes me look like I'm doing a bad De Niro impression. I mean, a lot of impressionable kids watch this. Or even worse, Southerners who love blowing shit up.
Oh, no. Was my love for this over-the-top, no-holds-barred entertainment taking a turn towards judgment? Was this no longer going to be my life? But before I could get too into my own head, Jarrett snapped me out of it.
Randy Orton, he said stone-faced.
Yes, Randy Orton, I agreed. I wonder if he went too far.
No, Jarrett said, looking past me. Randy Orton is coming right for us.
I looked behind me, and like a bull charging towards a matador, Randy Orton was out our window before I had time to react. He threw open the door, and we all screamed like little girls.
You're in my car, he said, taking a moment to look each of us directly in our eyes.
If that moment were a children's book, it would be titled, Orton Hears a Who the Fuck is in My Car? But it didn't register. We sat there, frozen.
You're in my... Then reality hit us.
Sorry, Randy Orton, I said. So sorry, sir, Grace said, equally terrified.
The next 20 seconds were composed of about 40 more sorries and sirs through shaking voices as we slid out of that car like flattened cartoon characters. The Escalade with Orton in it peeled off, kicking up the slightest bit of dust onto three stunned idiots holding chairs.
Guys, I told you from the start of this book that I was going to always be honest with you, so here it is. I peed my pants a little in that moment. Not like a full go change your pants before we go out type of way, but I definitely had a momentary loss of control of bodily fluids when I saw that 6'5", 250-pound beast coming at us while I was talking shit about him. People can talk about wrestling being fake all they want, but in that moment, the fear was real. And really fun. All in all, I urge you to attend all the silly events you can. Don't be a snob. What you might have cast off as being dumb or too lame or just straight up beneath you might be your new obsession waiting to happen. Go find reasons to say, this is my life now. I promise it'll be worth it.
Somebody rockin' knockin' the boots.
When my dear friend Kelly invited me to her wedding in the mountains of North Carolina, it was a no-brainer. Sometimes you get an invite to a wedding you'd need to travel across the country for, and it's like, no thanks, here's your toaster. But this one was right up my alley. The wedding invite teased biscuits, barbecue, and blueberry moonshine, a service held under a giant oak tree, and the reception in a barn. Plus, all the guests could rent beautiful cabins on the property. I had met Kelly briefly in college, but we became tight when we both lived in New York City. She was killing the game as a playwright, while I was busy mastering the art of playing wrong. Although we didn't know each other until our early 20s, we'd grown up 30 miles from each other, weirdly enough. There's something so lovely about sitting at brunch with a girlfriend, talking about rubbing elbows with a celeb at a fancy party the night before, knowing good and well that you both used to consider a Friday night at the Winston-Salem Ruby Tuesday to be the epitome of class. It wasn't even a question of whether I would go. Not only would I be able to spend time during my favorite season in my home state, I had yet to go to a wedding as a now single woman. I love weddings. The open bar, the dancing, the rituals. I am in top form at a wedding. But I'd never had the infamous wedding hookup, like you see in all the movies and or the remnants of during brunch the morning after. I was ready to get tipsy at a wedding and not just flirt with the groom's grandma. I wanted real sparks. Plus, it was Kelly's wedding, so there were particular potential suitors I already had my eye on. Allow me to explain. Kelly has three brothers in the Marines, two still single. Though I'd never met them in person, I'd seen pictures of them on her blog and in her Facebook albums for years. These men looked like Marine Ken dolls. I had never pictured myself with a military man, but they were both hot as hell. Plus, there would be an added bonus that, if all went well, I could potentially end up being Kelly's sister. Win all around. Let me take this moment to say with all my heart, family, Kohlrabi. I mean it. Don't say to yourself, well, I made it through her first book and was still able to look her in the eyes over Thanksgiving.
Stop listening right now or skip to the next chapter. Are you guys gone? Okay, good. Because this chapter is about the first and only time I've ever had a threesome. Stick with me. As the wedding drew closer, I was getting giddier and giddier. I had actually stayed put in LA for a month. I had finished my press tour for Dirty 30 and been finishing some other deadlines, which kept me glued to my ancient Mac. Days were spent click-clacking on my keyboard, while nights were spent hanging out with my pussy posse. Oh, what's this pussy posse, you ask? Well, in Hollywood, it is sometimes the name given to the trio of Leo DiCaprio, David Blaine, and Tobey Maguire because they used to unabashedly go out and get so much pussy. Fuck that, I thought to myself. Pussy is power, not some descriptor for these dudes to use their celebrity to bed women. When I decided post-pity party that I needed to just be surrounded by women for a minute and not let myself get wrapped up in one dude, I found that my closest girlfriends were feeling the same way. So I started calling my clique the Pussy Posse. I even got us all rose gold bangle bracelets with Pussy Posse 2017 engraved on them as little reminders throughout the day. They felt like Wonder Woman cuffs warding off bullshit. Maybe it was something astrological. Maybe some moon was moving into its fifth house, or maybe I had just drank too many fifths, but we were over it. We all wanted to focus on our careers, our friendships, and ourselves. Guys were just meant to be a fun, no-strings-attached good time. You know, like seizing the opportunity to hang out with a couple hot brothers at a wedding. Pussy power, indeed. With that mindset in place, I couldn't wait to get away for a minute. Everyone was going to be staying in a little town called Ferguson, which had little to do and zero cell reception. Sure, as soon as the wedding was complete and my phone received a bar of service, work emails would rush in like people jamming into a rush hour subway car. But for those few days, all I would have was peace and quiet. I couldn't wait. My cabin mate was going to be Kelly's friend Maggie, who is a magical creature from Iceland. She and I had hit it off after we spent a day together in L.A. when Kelly recommended that Maggie take some photos of me. She'll always hold a special place in my heart, seeing as she took the first picture I used for that first Raya dating profile. That picture is attached in the PDF, and it is completely unnecessary to the plot of this story, but I look hot in it, so I'm going to put it in a book, you know. I was excited to catch up with her and chill with some of her friends, the other bunkmates who I'd yet to meet. But, wouldn't you know it, a week before the wedding, I got a super apologetic email from Mags. Mamrie, so sorry, but my travel visa wouldn't go through. However, CC'd on this email is Dustin. Dustin, this is Mamrie. She's wonderful. Mamrie, this is Dustin. He's wonderful. And y'all will be staying in the cabin together. Go forth. Be best friends. Ugh. Was this ideal? No, but I trusted her recommendation. Within 5 minutes, Dustin had reached out to introduce himself and offer a ride from the airport, since we were landing around the same time. Now, normally, I would rather throw a cup of fire ants down my pants than take a ride with a stranger on a road trip. But I was still working out my license fiasco, and the only thing that's worse than a couple hours in a tiny rental car with a stranger is standing for hours at the DMV. Well, we all know there is something worse, and that's being fake hit on by a cop only to get a ticket for your expired license that ends up costing you tons of money and fees, and I'm trying to move past that. So I took Dustin up on his offer and prayed for minimal amounts of awkward silence. I landed in North Carolina after a red eye and met Dustin at the Enterprise line. We immediately hit it off. Sorry this is your first impression of me, I said, handing him the chai latte that I had offered to pick up for him from my terminal. I'm literally on zero sleep. I couldn't get comfortable on my flight. I'm in the same boat. I stayed out till 5 last night and had an 8 a.m. flight, Dustin told me, which explained why he was still wearing sunglasses inside. In a rom-com, this moment would be called a meet-cute, where a future romantic couple meets in an amusing way. However, there were no sparks between us. This was our meet-cute new BFS edition, Dustin and Mamrie. Aren't they adorbs? We gabbed the whole way up the mountain, whipping around the turns in our Kia Soul. I learned that Dustin and Kelly knew each other from grad school, when she was in the playwriting program and he was an actor. Dustin grew up in Pennsylvania with a big family who owned and ran a local Italian restaurant. I made him regale me with tales of his sisters being waitresses and him and his brothers working the line and being busboys during high school. I was dying to know what their best dish was and just how long they let their marinara simmer. I'm going to Italy in a few weeks. You should come, I said, immediately regretting my words. I mean, who does that? The lack of sleep must have been making me crazy because inviting someone on a trip abroad after knowing them an hour is like asking a guy to move in with you on the first date. Luckily, we breezed past it and kept chatting. As we drove, I blabbed about how much I love North Carolina in this weather and wouldn't shut up about how delicious Bojangles biscuits are, making him stop at the nearest one. And wouldn't you know it? They were out of biscuits. That's like KFC running out of chicken. But it was all good. We just laughed about it and continued down the road with Bowberry Biscuit Blue Balls. We were having such a nice time shooting the shit as our car maneuvered through the mountain roads that I wasn't even concerned when our final bar of service disappeared, a moment that would normally be a pound the alarm, mayday, mayday moment for me. We stopped to get groceries, and I introduced him to his first Food Lion experience, where he was called out by a local for having trendy sweatpants that were hemmed a little shorter than normal. Honestly, you would have thought Dustin was wearing Gaga's meat dress by the way the old man was staring at his exposed ankles. Once we pulled into the grounds, we knew we were in for a treat when we saw the big, gorgeous cabins dotting the mountains. I couldn't wait to see which one Maggie had reserved for us. "Do you care if our cabin is the party house?" I asked Dustin. "It better be. I did not break out these revealing fancy sweatpants to not be the party house." I looked up to a house with a massive wraparound porch. "Get me drinking some pumpkin beer up in some fall-ass foliage ASAP," I exclaimed, as our car rounded the corner and revealed the Welcome Center stables and barn. "The barn! That's where the reception's going to be right after the..." I looked to the left, and there it was. "Service under the old oak tree. God, this is perfect." Inside the Welcome Center, Dustin checked in, which... I'm sorry, that is hilarious. Dustin checked in. It's so close to Dunstan Checks In, no doubt one of the top three films to ever feature an orangutan as an unruly hotel guest. Meanwhile, I perused the quaint gift shop. It was like a mini Cracker Barrel. Little wooden games, rock candy, fleeces, and small signs painted with uplifting and somewhat Christian quotes lined the store. I ran my hand along the wind chimes when something caught my eye on the top shelf. There, shining down on me like a beacon of light from the heavens, was a pair of cowboy boots unlike any I had ever seen. These beauties were white, with shiny gold and silver leather stitching in the shape of a cowboy silhouette and a cactus, with metallic fringe accenting the sides. They were magnificent. It was like that moment in Wayne's World when Wayne first sees Cassandra. Dreamweaver was playing in my mind, and I uttered, "They will be mine. Oh, yes, they will be mine." This was a lens flare moment. "How much do you want for the boots?" I asked, carrying them up to the sweet older woman at the check-in desk. "Those boots?" she asked, her twang in full force. "Well, I don't know if those boots are for sale." "Patty! Hey, Patty, is Deborah selling her boots?" Patty, another silver-haired honey, slowly made her way to the desk. "Those boots? Deborah's boots?" Patty asked, as I wished there was a meter counting how many times the word boots was going to be said in the course of this conversation. Patty continued, "I think those boots are just up there for decoration. I don't think she's selling those boots. But how much would you pay for them?" "Aha! This granny was trying to pull a fast one on me. Trying to sell me poor Deborah's boots for probably way more than they cost because this vision from L.A. was asking about them. Hell, she might even pocket the money." "I'll tell you what," I said, kicking off my rank tennis shoes. "I'll try them on, take them for a little spin, and when I come back, you tell me how much you want for them." I'm not sure if I ever felt that smooth in my whole life. As I started to slip them on, I questioned whether I really needed silver and gold metallic boots with fringe. But that doubt went out the window as soon as I stood up. They fit perfectly, like they were custom-made for me. After a couple of figure eights and boot scootin' boogies, I twirled back to Patty. "How much for 'em?" I asked, squinting my eyes to intimidate the old broad. She squinted right back, and then finally, $50. "Sold!" I screamed, attempting to fist bump her, to no avail. Dustin grabbed our keys, and I do-si-do'd right out of that front door. We got back to our Kia Soul and plugged the address into the GPS, hoping the residual Wi-Fi from the Welcome Center would direct us to one of the palatial cabins up the mountain. Based on the website, the views overlooking the trees were straight off a postcard. "That's funny. It says it's within 100 yards, Dustin commented. We followed the directions to our destination, only to reveal that our dream cabin was, no lie, the stable house behind the horse barns. It was a shack. Maybe it won't be that bad," I squeaked, not even believing myself.
We approached it slowly, as if we were walking into a house on hoarders. When we opened the door, what we found was a time capsule from the early 90s. Hey, I am all about that country shabby chic, but this was shabby chicken house. Rooster art was everywhere. Rooster clock, rooster dish towels, rooster pillows, massive decorative glass roosters. The sofas were overstuffed and brown, like the loaf of bread they serve you when you sit down at Outback Steakhouse that you say you aren't going to eat so you can save room for a bloomin' onion, but you always end up eating. I opened the closet, which led to a massive laundry room with 6 washers and dryers. Clearly, this was where all the stable stuff was washed. The screened-in back porch, a selling point in Maggie's pitch, was full of knickknacks, old furniture, and a weird miniature pool table with a felt so worn it had bald spots. Dustin pointed to what looked to be a rusty kennel for a 50-plus pound dog. He looked at me and said in a deadpan tone, "Yes, Mamrie, it's that bad." He was right. But being the go-with-the-flow people we were, we did what anyone would do. We called the front desk and begged Patty to find us another cabin. But they were all booked. Our dreams of running from room to room and claiming the best one for ourselves, a la the first episode of every Real World season, were crushed. "Well, you know what this means," I said, breaking into the wine we got from Food Lion. "We're just going to have to get good and ripped to deal with our digs. Let's start now." And that was that. A few hours later, we were gathered around the heat lamps at the welcome dinner. But we didn't just have burning propane to keep us warm. We had an internal heating system, and by that I mean we had a moonshine. Blueberry moonshine and apple moonshine, to be specific, which aren't like the real moonshine that could start a small engine, but they'll still get your aunt to bump and grind on the dance floor. I was in heaven. "Mames, I have something for you," Kelly said, pulling me aside. She looked gorgeous in her cute dress and denim jacket. Not that she doesn't always look gorge, but she definitely had that inexplicable bride glow to her. "From our local state trooper," she said, handing me a mason jar of clear liquid out of her tote bag. "It's the real stuff." That's right. The bride handed me a legit jar of white lightning as a thank you for making it to the wedding. Ladies who are currently Pinteresting your perfect day, take note. But before I could twist off the lid to make a lightning storm in my mouth, I spotted them. Dreamweaver kicked back in, but this time it wasn't for 2 boots. It was for 2 dudes who had been to boot camp, a.k.a. Kelly's brothers. They looked as if a witch had been walking through a Grecian statue garden, made 2 of the carved studs come to life, and then tossed a fleece and khakis on them. Not too bad, right? I whipped my head around and saw 2 of Kelly's bridesmaids, whom I'd met once or twice, and who, for the sake of anonymity, we'll call Ronnie and Bonnie. "Get mine, girl," Ronnie said, holding her hand up to the heat lamp. "Oh, Jesus, we're all gunning for a brother, huh?" They nodded. "Well, just so you know, I have 0 preference. I'll take whoever you don't want." "Yeah, we feel the same way," Bonnie piped in. "I guess it's just every woman for herself." And with that, she strutted away to talk to the youngest one. Son of a bitch! I thought this was going to be like shooting fish in a barrel. Not only did I have competition, it was with 2 total hotties. God damn it. I beelined it straight to Dustin. "We need more moonshine," I said, grabbing his arm and forcing him to the bar. 2 more shots and I explained the situation. "Oh, brother." "Literally," Dustin said with an eye roll I was already accustomed to from our brief time knowing each other. The rest of the evening got a little blurry as I was pretty, pretty, pretty lit. But I do remember distinctly hanging out on a porch with the 2 bros and the competition. I don't remember one damn thing I said to them, though. Nor do I remember a bunch of people coming back to our place to attempt to play pool or eating an entire bag of spicy, sweet, chili-flavored Doritos. But I do remember how bad my mouth hurt when I woke up. I must have dove into those treacherous triangles like I'd been stranded at sea for a week. The next afternoon, Dustin and I took the Kia Soul up through the winding mountain roads dotted with the mountain mansions we wish we were staying in. We happened upon a swing set a little ways off from a house with no cars in the driveway, and decided to grab a seat and pop open some pumpkin beers. "I can't believe everyone is going after the brothers," I said, gaining some real height as I pumped my legs. I looked down at Dustin, who was throwing me a bitch please look a la Jack Hay from 227. "You know what you gotta do, right? You gotta wear your lucky boots." "Lucky boots? Why are they lucky?" I asked, stopping my rocking. "Because so far on this trip, you've gotten exactly what you wanted." "Not true,"
I am not currently perched on one of the brothers' faces.
True, but besides that, you've been batting 1,000.
I was caught off guard by Dustin dropping such a seamless baseball reference.
Think about it. You're drinking seasonal beer with some fall-ass foliage, as you so eloquently put it, and we have the party house.
Sure, it might just because it's the closest place to party without having to drive drunk up a mountain, but still.
I nodded.
Our trash cabin was everyone's getting trashed cabin. I gave a little grin and started to swing again.
Now pound that, and let's go get ready in our super convenient little shit shack back down the mountain. I am not driving once it starts getting dark.
I see a picture of Dustin and I on the swing set that day, drinking that pumpkin beer.
When it came to the wedding day, Operation Brother Lover wardrobe, I was pulling no punches. I knew that Ronnie and Bonnie would be in classy yet sexy bridesmaids' dresses. Kelly had great taste. And they were probably up in a fancy cabin getting their hair and makeup professionally done while drinking champagne. Meanwhile, Dustin and I got ready in our shack. I had taken for granted that the place would have a blow dryer, so I roasted my roots over the radiator while pounding Bud Light Lime. I put on a short peach dress, despite it being frigid as hell, and a denim jacket, and I slid on those magical boots, a.k.a. my secret weapon. My new metallic kicks were made for walking, and I was ready to give Ronnie and Bonnie the boot. I froze my ass off at that ceremony, which was gorgeous and under a big oak tree, and Kelly was hilarious and beautiful, and I am so sorry this is what I'm talking about regarding your wedding. It was really lovely, though. Then it was on to the reception. Everyone moseyed over to the barn, which was decorated in a way that can only be described as fall as fuck. Big communal wooden tables, little mason jars of wildflowers, burlap accents everywhere. Dustin and I made our way directly to the bar where they were ladling out hot cider. I'll take one of those, I said, breathing into my hands to warm them up.
Oh, can you put some of that apple pie moonshine in there?
I don't see why not, the bartender said and started making my drink.
Hey, that's a great idea.
I looked back and saw Kelly's oldest brother behind me in line.
I thought so, I said, smiling over my shoulder, essentially doing an impression of the smirk emoji.
Great boots, by the way.
Holy shit.
It was working. Dustin and I took our spike ciders and found our table, of course with him shaking his head at me. Mind you, we'd known each other 24 hours at this point, but it felt as though we'd been friends for ages. The reception was thoughtful and wonderful, with little individual cobblers and tiny mason jars and a spread of North Carolina barbecue, complete with a barbecue jackfruit option for us crazy out-of-town vegans. By the time everyone was ready to rip it up on the dance floor, the wine and shine had been flowing, so we youngsters were ready to boogie. I hit that parquet dance floor with a mission, busting out all my best moves. The brothers were busy doing their mandatory chatting with the great aunts and friends of their parents whom they probably didn't know by name. I occasionally glanced over while shaking my ass in my short dress and flipping my hair in the wind, a stark contrast from Ronnie and Bonnie's tasteful navy floor length and updos with baby's breath. Let me tell you, there is a fine line between shaking your ass to get someone's attention and going a little too sexy to Sam Cooke's greatest hits as several grandparents watch. That said, I was feeling good that night and having a blast. I kicked up my cowboy boots, did shots, and then pulled off my ultimate chill girl move. All the ladies huddled on the dance floor, including Ronnie and Bonnie, as Kelly turned her beautiful low-back lace dress to throw us the bouquet. As it left her hands and everyone did their slow-mo lunge toward it, I crossed my arms and ran in the opposite direction. No thanks, I said playfully, winking at the youngest brother. You could practically hear Dustin rolling his eyes. After several songs, I took a breather. Dancing while sucking in a stomach full of jackfruit barbecue is exhausting.
I just heard them talking about how hot you are, Dustin said, nodding towards the bros.
Really?
I mean, I asked very nonchalantly.
Finally, the brothers went from getting their cheeks pinched by elderly ladies while side-eyeing the dance floor to getting out there themselves. Now was my time to shine, and I went in for the kill. I would dance with one brother, then see the other one make his way over and saunter over to him for a minute. Both seemed to be into it. The only problem was, it was working for Ronnie and Bonnie, too. We would eye each other from across the room, trading between bros. It was like a fucked-up square dance meets that dance scene from Mr. and Mrs. Smith when Brad's and Angie's characters are half tangoing, half about to shoot each other. Just when I thought one of the brothers was into it, he'd be dipping Ronnie, and I'd start being spun by the other bro. By the end of the night, all bets were off. The older folks had made their way to the cabins, and the barn belonged to all of Kelly and her hubby's friends. Based on the super classy photo booth pic I took, pretending a gray wig was a merkin, I'd say Mama was feeling the grain alcohol. Slowly but surely, couples and groups of non-singles started to peel off. But we three women stood strong, convincing the bartender to give us each one last drink as we watched the brothers take the final photo booth pics with their family. "Don't y'all have to go all the way back up the mountain?" I asked, sipping my now straight shine. "I think the last shuttle is leaving in a second. Better hop in it."
"We'll walk," Ronnie said, as Bonnie nodded.
God damn it. No one was backing down. You know those hands-on-a-hard-body competitions they used to have in the 90s? People would have to keep one hand on a car without taking it off, and the last person standing wins the car? Sometimes it would take days, but you gotta do what you gotta do for a free Dodge Neon. This was just like that. It was a hands-on-a-hard-body competition, except, in this case, the hard bods were crafted to Marine standards. Finally, the wedding party was done with their props and poses and started moseying our way. It was the moment of truth. We were the final five hanging on, under the warmth of a heat lamp, as the rest of the wedding party started getting into a van. I smiled at the older brother. He smiled back. As soon as he looked away, I smiled at the younger brother, who smiled too, and cleared his throat. He opened his mouth with a grin, and just as I think he's about to officially make a move, we hear one of those two fingers in the mouth type of whistles. We looked over to see Kelly's dad motioning the brothers over to their van. Kelly, in all her gowned gorgeousness beside him with her hands on her hips, yelling, "Insert brother's name here! Insert brother's name here! Y'all can barely keep your eyes open! Let's roll!" And just like that, they were gone. The three of us stood there in shock in an otherwise empty barn. There we were, just three girls who had thrown all their energy and time into claiming one of the brothers, all worked up from it, only to be left teeth chatteringly cold and drunk in a barn. But all was not lost. Remember when I said that this story was the first time I had a threesome? Yep, it was that type of threesome. Ha ha! Gotcha! You thought I had slept with the brothers based on that brilliant setup. Well, sorry, darling listener. Twist ending. You just got M. Night Shyamalan'd. Now I will stop gloating long enough to finish the tale. I woke up the next morning with a hangover that could rival a Boston frat boy's on March 18th. I looked down, totally butt naked, except those boots, sparkling in the morning sun. I wrapped a sheet around me and walked into the living room to find Dustin lounging on the Outback bread couch. Well, good morning, sunshine. Sounds like someone had fun last night. Wasn't expecting that. That makes two of us, I said as he handed me a coffee. We stared at each other, shaking our heads, and then just started laughing. What was my life? A year ago, I felt like I was a crabby wife in every CBS sitcom, complaining that she had a headache or was too tired, all while putting on hand cream from my side of the bed, because they do that in every sitcom. But not anymore. I had just slept with two bridesmaids. What? When did I become Owen Wilson in the opening credits of Wedding Crashers? I stood there, sex hair, and a look of bewilderment like I just survived the hurricane vagina of 2016, which is ironic considering that we were staying in the House of Cock. I mean, guys! The only thing I was wearing besides boots was my rare gold bangle. Pussy Posse had taken a whole new meaning. Get dressed, he said. I still need to try Bojangles biscuits. And that was that. 3 weeks later, I was sitting in a gondola in Venice, gliding through the canals with two of my closest girlfriends and my new friend Dustin. It was a perfect day. We took in the sights, sitting on the red velvet seats, huddled under blankets, as our driver navigated the boat through the bends. Maybe my boots weren't just lucky because they brought me one of my top 10 weirdest nights of my life. They also brought me Dustin, my favorite kind of person. The type of person who will agree to meet you and your two girlfriends in a different country after knowing you for 72 hours. Dustin, you're Italian, right? His head whipped to me as he offered up an eye roll. The man grew up in rural Pennsylvania, but I had been asking him questions throughout this trip as if he spent his whole life in Italia. Yes, Mamrie. I am Italian. Then you'll know the answer to this. Where are we right now? Like, if Italy is a boot, where is Venice? Northeast, right at the top, he said, as the gondola got stuck under one of those tiny bridges. Within a few seconds, we were back in the sunshine, taking in all the heat we could get from its beams. But
While we're on the subject of boots, Dustin said with a smirk on his face, whap! I kicked Dustin in the exposed ankle of his edgy sweatpants before my friends could pick up on what he was saying. He laughed. It didn't matter that we had just met each other a few weeks before. It felt like I'd been friends with Dustin forever. He was what they call a keeper, mainly because he could keep my secrets. And there's Dustin and I on a bridge in Venice. What a couple wackadoos. Weirdest day. Have you ever heard someone ask, what were you doing the day Kennedy was shot? Anyone over the age of 60 knows exactly where they were and what they were doing when they found out the news. Now, I'm not old enough to have experienced that particular day in history, but there are other moments that feel this distinct and memorable to me. Like when 9/11 happened, I was in the middle of a small college class about ancient Pompeii. Why did a lazy college freshman theater major decide to take an intensive course on a first century city? I asked myself that every class. And actually, in truth, it's because the description of the class said that each student would assume a role in the class. Naturally, I wanted to be a serf solely so I could say, "Surf's up," every chance I got. Anyway, another moment that will always stand out to me is finding out when Michael Jackson died. I was walking through Tompkins Square Park in New York, listening to music, when a text came in on my BlackBerry from Megan. Have you heard? Michael Jackson died. So sad. Frowny face emoji. I stopped in my tracks, and I must have had a look of total shock on my face because I heard a man say, "She just found out." I looked over to see two bums sitting on a bench, trash bags piled high beside them. I looked at them and nodded sadly. In retrospect, I find it kind of hilarious that two homeless men with zero access to the internet knew before me. That's how wrapped up I was in the debut Lady Gaga album blasting from my iPod. Yes, kids, I am that old. But what I'm saying is that there are these moments in life where it feels like you are connected to everyone around you because you're all grieving. Never have I felt this camaraderie and sadness more distinctly than in November 2016 when Donald Trump was elected. This sobering moment was a lot of things for a lot of people, but for me and my girlfriends on a whirlwind trip abroad, it was the five stages of grief in 24 hours. Let me back up. A few weeks prior to Election Day, I got an email asking if I'd be interested in moderating a panel about social media at a convention called Web Summit. While I had never been a moderator before, I figured it'd be a breeze. Everyone just wants you to get through a short list of generic questions so you can turn the floor over to the audience for a Q&A. I would be interviewing two heartthrobish type vloggers, so Lord knows the audience would be chomping at the bit for me to stop talking so they could ask the vloggers how their dogs are doing or if they could get a hug. This conference was going to be in Lisbon, Portugal. Y'all remember how painless my panel was in Cannes. I basically got a free trip to talk for 5 minutes and then hang out and make MIP puns. But unlike Cannes, I wasn't part of a crew this time. This was a solo trip. As much as I like to travel alone, I wasn't feeling an unaccompanied adventure. Plus, I had popped by Lisbon post-Amsterdam trip for a couple of days, and it wasn't really a solo city based on the amount of discarded purses laying around. An idea started brewing. My travel buddy Jocelyn and I had been talking the day before about how our next big trip together needed to be Italy. After that one afternoon in Pisa, specifically that one plate of pasta with cream sauce that will be my death row last meal if my life goes really differently, fucked up all other pastas for me. And I love pasta. But every time I ordered a plate of carby goodness, I knew it wasn't going to be as good as it was in Pisa. So I asked the convention if, in lieu of a first-class ticket, they could instead give me three round-trip coach tickets flying into Lisbon and out of Florence. That way, Jocelyn and my other friend, Nada, could come with me. One night in Lisbon, then Italia. I knew it was a big ask, but they went for it. And actually, it probably saved them money. A few weeks of counting down the days and being tempted to do a throwback Thursday of my pick of that pasta, and we were on our way to the airport. It was Election Day, and we would be flying from L.A. to New York to Lisbon. I had mailed my ballot weeks earlier, and I was happy to get in the air, away from the internet and the endless scrolling of I voted sticker pics on Instagram. Isn't it crazy that when we land in Lisbon, we'll have our first female president? I asked my girls as we settled into our row. I'm going to bawl my eyes out, Jocelyn said, squeezing into the window seat. What if Trump wins? Nada asked. We all laughed. In what world? I brushed it off. There was no need to give any thought to the idea of Trump being elected. That was like living in L.A. and just sitting around waiting for an earthquake to hit. It was a waste of energy. Okay, when we get there, I'm going to have to haul ass to get showered and head to my panel, which is annoying because I just want to hang out with you guys, I said, flipping my tiny seat TV to some mindless HGTV. But it doesn't matter because tomorrow night, we are going to be in the streets of Lisbon, toasting to Hillary and having a delicious dinner. Here's the thing about me. I am known among my friends for my love of a delicious dinner. I can get through any workday, any shoot, any bullshit, as long as I know that a relaxed, delicious dinner will close out my day. It is one of my sole motivations in life. Back when I did a travel show with my friend Grace, we were asked to do all sorts of insane activities. Salmon fishing, spelunking, shooting guns, you name it. I could be freezing in a wetsuit, having whitewater rafted all day, but by focusing on that delicious dinner, I could get through it. My other mantra to get me through anything is hot showers, cold martinis. Being cramped into a tiny coach seat with nothing to eat but peanuts for half a day would be worth it, as long as I got a good meal with a big glass of wine after the sun went down. We landed at JFK for our three-hour layover around 10 p.m., and I immediately went to the closest bar with a TV, which turned out to be the little tapas place in the JetBlue terminal. I bopped up to that bar with a little kick in my step and ordered a glass of Rioja. But that kick in my step turned into a punch in the gut when I saw the screen. Trump was in the lead. It was unthinkable. Actually, I'll go ahead and take a whole bottle, I said to the waiter, who gave me an understanding nod back. The three of us sat there, anxiously stress-eating our patatas bravas, barely talking as Trump clinched Florida and North Carolina. That last one especially hurt because there was a chance for my home state to turn blue that year. Between their discriminatory laws restricting transgender public bathroom usage and other bigotry on display, North Carolina felt like that shitty boyfriend you're always making excuses for, claiming that their words and actions don't actually reflect their heart. Like, look, I know he called you a pansy-ass bitch, but pansies are a vibrant and lush flower. It was totes a compliment. I felt betrayed by North Carolina and was glad I'd left that tumultuous relationship in my early 20s. By the time we had to peel ourselves away from the bar to board, Trump was only 30-something electoral votes away from sealing the deal. Despite the odds, there was still hope in my head that it wasn't going to happen. This election had been so fraught with ratings and conspiracies, maybe all the news channels just needed viewers to stay tuned, so they were reporting the Trump states before all the Hillary ones to keep people's attention. We boarded our flight, saying goodbye to the internet for the next 10 hours. It'll be okay, Jocelyn assured us from our aisle seats. When we wake up, Hillary will be president and Donald Trump will be so embarrassed he'll just fade away. Let's just get some sleep. But sleep I did not. I was wide awake that whole 10-hour flight. Since we were flying over the ocean, we didn't have Wi-Fi or live TVs, so I opted to watch everything they had on demand. Not even the dull delivery of astrophysics jokes on the Big Bang Theory could lull me to slumber. After what felt like years, the waitress started coming down the aisles with breakfast snack carts. One by one, people's sleepy peepers were pried open by the smell of shitty coffee and the realization that wheels were rolling over their feet. Once we had our little snack and got our wits about us, the pilot started speaking on the microphone in Portuguese. I pulled up my seat and put away my tray table. I don't speak Portuguese, but I do know the "we have started our initial descent" speech by heart. I was halfway through throwing my sneakers back on before the whole plane gasped. Joss and Nada and I looked at one another in terror, each grasping the other's thigh with a death grip. That kind of collective gasp could only mean one of two things. One, a flock of birds have flown into the engine and the pilot is about to have to sully this bitch to safety. Or two, Trump had won. We waited with bated breath for the pilot's message to be translated into English. Ladies and gentlemen, I would just like to inform you that Donald Trump has won the presidency of the United States of America. He kept talking, but in that moment, I blacked out. Immediately, the three of us started bawling. Questions swirled through my head. How could this happen? Why the fuck would the pilot tell us while we're still in the air? Did we actually ascend into the stratosphere? Because everything felt like it was in slow motion. For that next hour, I tried to squelch my sobs and fight off a panic attack. I had seen the safety demonstration of when the oxygen masks fall from the overhead in case of cabin pressure changing upward of 8 million times, always hoping I would never have to see it in real life. Now, I was wishing those bags of oxygen would just plop on our face so I could catch my breath. What if the pilot got the news wrong? I said, with a glimmer of hope in my leaking eyes. I mean, what if someone told him that as a joke and he took it seriously? Captains are known for their kooky hijinks.